Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to
The Men About It
on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
I'm Mary Izette.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Rachel Jacobs.
And we're your co-hosts through this weekly journey of all things fermented.
Archived on Stitcher, iTunes, and right here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Welcome to episode 170. We're very happy to be here. It's hot, 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 hot in New York City.
That is an understatement.
No, it's cooled down. We had a massive monsoon, mini monsoon this afternoon. It's only 78, but it was 92 earlier. It's true.
Yeah. It's definitely affecting my brewing. How about you guys?
Yes, definitely. So we're going to talk about that. So let's talk about that now. Let's start with that. All right. So that's it. That's one issue for summertime is if you don't have temperature control, or even if you do have temperature control, you're usually most of us don't have cool boxes or fermentation tank. Yeah. So, you know, you're dealing with some kind of restrictions regardless. Chris and I have a couple of chest freezers that have pretty adequate space, but, you know, everything has its limits. And our apartment's sitting around 85 degrees when I left today. So we definitely have to be very careful about what we keep outside of those temperature-controlled chest freezers. So what can you do? So I kind of wanted to do a review of both beverages that are great to ferment in this weather, as well as some basic kind of techniques and equipment that you can purchase or create for yourself. So let's start highbrow, actually. I think that's where we should start.
All right.
So Brew Jacket, for those of you who have been to National Homebrewers Conference, or if you have a pretty fancy homebrew store near you, you might have seen these before. It's made by Brew Jacket. And originally they had a cooling only. So this is basically a controlled stick that goes into your fermenter. So if you're using a carboy, it basically sits on top of your carboy and the stick hangs down into your carboy. They've had one for cooling only. It's called immersion. And basically it's great for making lagers in any situation. You can achieve 35 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius below ambient and maintain that temperature to within half a degree for as long as this immersion is plugged in. Those are at $2.99. They have just now...
I was about to ask why you were calling it highbrow, and then that answered that.
Yes, so highbrow meaning, you know, more expensive. So obviously this is an investment, but particularly if you're into making lagers and you don't want to deal with, you don't have room for a chest freezer in your house or apartment or whatever reason, this is a great way to be able to make 5 gallons of a lager at any given time.
And there's always the dichotomy where I want to drink light lagers in the summertime, but I can't make light lagers in the summertime unless you have this cold.
And this is a great way to do it. With minimal intervention, you would be able to go away for a day or two. You know, you don't have to babysit this thing. This thing works great on its own. They also have them for the cylinder fermenters as well. They just are coming out in September is an immersion plus pro upgrade. It's going to do heating and cooling, which is awesome because we live in this old school loft here in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and our loft gets to, I don't know, around 51 degrees ambient temperature in most rooms in the winter, and like I said earlier, 85 degrees in the summer. So we have to find tricks outside, you know, besides the temperature controlled chest fears, there's little tricks or places that we can keep things warm in the winter and cool in the summer. So this is a great thing. This is going to do heating and cooling. So again, it can achieve 35 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius above or below ambient and maintain that temperature within half a degree. That's going to be $369. It's not available yet, but it will be. You can pre-order it now on their website. That's brewjacket.com.
Does it have a limit or a minimum of liquid that it can handle?
No, that is a good question, and I don't know. I was just wondering that as I was speaking, and I have to look it up. They do have compatible fermenters. Let me look at the list of compatible. Whoa, that's a lot. So it looks like 6.5 gallon.
Is
the minimum?
Is the optimal.
Is maximum.
Okay, maximum.
Yeah, they have a whole list. If you go to their website, they have a whole list of fermenters that that these pieces of equipment will work with. So I'd say that's on the higher end. A chest freezer with a thermoregulator is going to run you
between...
I mean, you can get small chest freezers for as little as like $70 on sale a lot of times.
Yeah. Our 5-cubic foot one from Home Depot was $200, and it came with free delivery.
Oh, nice.
Which is pretty good. And then you can get... I would recommend a digital controller if you get one. They are much more accurate. We have the old kind and I hate it. It doesn't do very well. It doesn't keep
the old kind. When you moved in, we got digital for the other ones.
Yes. Anyway, so that's another option. Obviously, chest freezers you can control to pretty much, you know, any temperature that you want to. I also unplug one of our chest freezers in the winter, and I use it with a
grow mat.
Yeah, a grow mat, which is also temperature controlled. So a grow mat is basically like a plastic heating pad. It's larger than your standard heating pad that you use, you know, for your back or whatever.
It's usually for plants.
Right, to grow seedlings and in, you know, mini greenhouses. And it also has its own thermoregulator. So I purchased both of those items off Amazon. I don't remember how much they ran. I think I want to say like $60 total or something, 60 or 70, somewhere in that range. And that's great because I can stick that in there. I also can stick a 5 or 6 gallon better bottle. I actually fill it with water and put a brew belt on it, and I use that to also increase the ambient temperature. If you're not doing something with hops, if you're dealing with solid buckets or carboys that you cover with a dark t-shirt, you can also use a light bulb to heat up your unplugged chest freezer in the winter. So like if you had a chest freezer in the garage and that was where you're fermenting, your garage gets super cold in the winter, that's a way, you know, that you could do reverse, that you could keep temperatures a little bit warmer. Okay, so let's go to another piece of equipment that's definitely more affordable as well as very low tech. There's something called the Cool Brewing Insulated Fermentation Bag. I saw this for the first time 3 or 4 years ago, I guess, at the National Homebrewers Conference. And this is basically a giant soft side cooler that has a zipper at the top. And it accommodates, this is actually the second generation. So it can accommodate 6.5, 6 or 5 gallon fermenters. Basically, you freeze 2-liter soda bottles and you use those to maintain the temperature. They've designed it so that, for a typical 5-gallon batch, one frozen 2-liter bottle of water should lower wort temperature around 5 degrees, and then you could use two-liter bottles will lower wort temperature around 11 degrees for 24 to 36 hours. So obviously, again, this is going to depend on the ambient temperature of your apartment or house or garage or wherever you keep your fermentables. But that's a less expensive piece of equipment. It also stores pretty flat. I mean, this thing it's like a big soft-sided cooler, and you can get those at most of your homebrew supply stores. Then another way you can do it is by creating a water bath. So you basically are going to get any kind of plastic container. You can get a big plastic bin or tub at your, you know, local big box store or hardware store. And you're going to basically fill that with water. Make sure that it's big enough to fit your desired carboy or pail or bucket. You're going to fill that with cold water. You want to do that a third full with cold tap water. And then you are going to make sure that you want that water to be chilled to the same temperature as where you want to pitch your yeast. So if you're aiming for a 68 degree fermentation temperature, you know, obviously the fermentation will create energy and heat. So you want to keep it at, I don't know, I'd put it at like 62 to 64 degrees. And then basically using ice, you can manipulate that temperature. So water is acting like an insulator, just like a styrofoam cooler or refrigerator or anything like that. It's not only preventing dispersing the heat that your fermentation is creating into the water. It's absorbing that, but it's also preventing the ambient temperature in your house from basically, you know, creating causing your fermentation to get even higher. So it's absorbing on both sides. And, you know, it might take you a little while to get, it's obviously going to depend on how active your fermentation is, what size of container you're using. But if you monitor it, then you should be able to actually maintain a pretty decent temperature with minimal work. Again, you could do it with ice, but the other way is you could get a bunch of, you know, like 10 or 12 ounce water bottles, fill those with water, stick them in your freezer, and you could just switch those out. And that should be enough to keep your temperature down. I think those are the,
And like, we've talked about that before with doing the opposite for kettle souring, where we'll do water baths and just keep exchanging that water with hot water. So it's the same.
Exactly. And you could use that. So, right, with kettle souring, so where you want to maintain a temperature of, you know, somewhere between 105 and 115 degrees, you could do the same thing. I like to use aquarium
heaters.
Yes, aquarium heaters. I found two on Amazon that don't have, that go higher than your average aquarium heater. Do that, and then I just would rack out some of the water and add some boiling water. And I was able to keep pretty constant, you know, range, depending where I wanted, between 105 and 115, doing that, adding boiling water twice before I went to work and when I got home from work with no problem.
I have a question. With your very first homebrew, how did you cool your wort?
A ice bath, of course, in my sink. Well, and also, my first batch was extract, so I think I ended up adding, you know, cold filtered water.
Oh, interesting.
That's the nice thing about using extract, or a lot of times, even when I do all grain, I might, you know,
brew big and
yes, exactly, and dilute cool. With cold water, because especially in the summer, a lot of times, I mean, our tap water, there's a lot of things, but if you want, we're talking minimal equipment here, you know, minimal investment, and most of the time the cold water coming out of our tap is fine. It's just in the heat of summer, it's not as cold, so I don't need to have special equipment the majority of the time. I know that people who live in warmer climates like Florida or California or Arizona, anywhere around the world that it's hot, a lot of times their tap water doesn't get as cold, so you might have to use something else. Another thing I would do is just run the tubing I use a wort chiller now, so I'd run the in-tubing through an ice bath. So I'll just coil it all up and stick it in an ice bath, and that can help a little bit get your temperatures down. Or otherwise, I'll just brew a slightly stronger, higher gravity wort, less of it. So if I'm 5 gallons, I might brew 4 gallons, and then I'll compensate with a gallon of ice-cold water that's filtered. So what?
Those calculations are pretty easy to do.
Yes, yeah. I always
to find your target gravity.
Yeah, you exactly.
Take your overall.
Or if you don't care,
volume.
Like I do, exactly what you know, what your OG.
I'm
most
just saying,
of the
it's
time.
Not. It's not. I mean, you can do it scientifically to get to
yeah.
get your.
I think there's actually.
It's pretty easy to.
You should
do.
Be able to find an online calculator to do the exact same thing. I think that's what I always use is an online calculator.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about if you don't want to deal with that. So your brute. Also, I gotta say. Like I said, our apartment's 85 degrees, and our kitchen has we have no air conditioning in the entire apartment outside of our bedroom. So I don't want to brew beer in the summer. I mean, I've done it before, but it sucks. And I think a lot of people are the same way, especially if you're in an urban environment like New York City and you don't have central air. Air conditioning's expensive, and it's a pain. So a lot of times I'll brew things that aren't beer. One of my favorite things to brew in the summer is Sema. That's a fermented lemonade. If you've listened to the show, you've heard me talk about it before. It's probably my favorite summer beverage.
Oh, it's definitely one of mine. I've been
delicious.
A lot, yeah.
So it's basically lemonade. It's all natural. It's lemon juice. I usually add some lemon peel in there just to give it a little bit of the oils. You want to avoid too much of the pith. So fresh squeeze some lemons. You could mix it up and do lemon, lime, and or grapefruit and or orange. add sugar. You could use white sugar if you want a cleaner taste, or something like panela or jaggery sugar. Those are both less processed or unprocessed sugars that you can usually find in international stores. So if you have a grocery store that has a good international section, or you have a grocery store, Indian grocery store, Latin American grocery store, they'll usually have less processed sugars. I don't recommend brown sugar. Brown sugar is actually sugar that's been processed and then molasses has been added back to it. So these are actual unprocessed or less processed sugars. And they work really well, and they can give you a little bit more flavor than a white sugar. I use organic white sugar that I buy in bulk at Costco. It's very affordable there. And then champagne yeast. Champagne yeast is your friend in warm weather. A lot of the beer yeast that we know and love will throw off a lot of unpleasant or not as desirable off flavors and aromas. I had a Belgian triple that I made several years ago, and I had a pretty stable cellar at the time where I was keeping my beers, but we had a heat wave, and sure enough, the basement got a little bit hot, and that beer was nicknamed the Big Banana because it threw off a ton of banana. Phenolic, you know, estery profile.
But with some age, it actually tasted really
good. Yeah, it was delicious, but I
had to condition a while. It was a little stronger in the beginning.
Yeah, I had to hang on to that sucker for a while before it didn't taste like the Big Banana.
It wasn't as banana as Wells.
No. Banana bread. Yeah, that's true. Banana.
Which is good. Just like
that was purposefully
doses.
Banana, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Touché.
And then I always use a little bit of beer yeast nutrient. So whatever you do, any of these sugar-based beverages, use a little bit of beer yeast nutrient. You could also do this with honey or some other kind of sugar source. Basically, you can ferment any kind of fruit juice that has sugar in it. You can always supplement with sugar. If you buy some of the concentrates, you might need to cut those down. So you want to take gravity before so you have an idea of what's going in. And just stay away from serious preservatives. A little bit of citric acid is okay, but any of the sorbates or anything like that, those are put in there basically to prevent fermentation and spoilage. So they will slow down or prevent the fermentation that you want to have happen in order to turn your sugar into alcohol. So those are some of my favorite beverages to make during summer. Ooh, also the sema. I like to make fruit semas. So I'm a huge fan of freeze-dried fruit. I get it at Trader Joe's. It's a little pricey, but it packs a huge punch. So you really don't need very much. I like the freeze-dried strawberries. Freeze-dried raspberries are also delicious. Strawberry sema is probably, that probably is my favorite beverage to make in the summer. So I would say even just adding one packet of the Trader Joe's freeze-dried strawberries, which is around, I think it's around 1.2, 1.3 ounces in a 3-gallon batch will give you a lot of color and some really nice strawberry aroma and flavor.
Oh, yeah. I actually made one with fresh strawberries. It was mostly water in fresh strawberries, but it did still have like a strawberry taste. It definitely is it's pink.
Yeah.
Very
so you can always use fresh, but the freeze-dried are really easy, and they pack a big punch.
Really, any fruit that you had to sema, it's just going to make it more delicious.
The other thing I like to do is ferment tea in the summer. So again, I just make a sweet tea out of pretty much anything. You want to avoid things that have a ton of tannins, although if you like tannins, that will give you some balance. So herbal tea, you might want to add a packet or two of green tea to get that tannin to balance out the sweetness. But again, you know, you're just making your typical sweet tea that you would drink. And instead of drinking it, hit it with some champagne yeast and beer yeast nutrient and let it go. It's delicious and refreshing.
Yeah, I like that jasmine tea.
And the coconut lemongrass green tea. That's one of my favorites. Again, all of these things will go. The one thing you want to be careful of with sugar-based beverages. Also, I will mention that I do have exact recipes in my book, Speed Brewing. And I've since... There's a lot... Anything... If it has sugar in it, you can ferment it as long as it doesn't have a lot of preservatives. That's the rule here. Champagne is quick. It's clean. It tolerates low pHs as well as high temperatures. Where was I going to go with this?
I don't know. I just sneezed.
Gazoon tight.
Thank you.
I was talking about the tea.
Yes.
Oh, all of these things that sugar, unless you stop the fermentation at some point, they will go to... Yeah. They will eat that champagne yeast will work its way through every sugar, and you're going to end up with a very dry beverage that has less flavor. Now, if you like really dry beverages, that's awesome. But typically what I do is I stop it around 10:08. I like to cold crash, and then I bottle either into brown, those amber PET bottles, or I keg and force carbonate it and then just keep it cold. So again, if you're using plastic bottles, you could even use flip-top glass bottles if you're careful. I would recommend those that are rated for carbonated beverage, like the Grolsch bottles. Again, you know, you can set those out. The plastics are great because you can tell it's going to continue to ferment since it's not at terminal gravity. So if you set them out for 12 to 36 hours, you're going to be able to feel if it's carbonated. As soon as it's carbonated, as soon as that plastic is taut, go ahead and throw them in cold and then, you know, drink them in a relatively timely manner. Even if you're going to carbonate in flip tops, any of these beverages that have not hit their terminal gravity, if you carbonate them in flip tops, go ahead and carbonate one in an old water bottle so that at least you can tell when it's carbonated.
Oh, that's really good advice, actually.
Anyway, these are all these sugar-based beverages are very clean. They, you know, again, the champagne yeast tolerates high temperatures, so it won't throw off a lot of off flavors or things. Even if it's, you know, banana is not necessarily an off flavor in every beverage, but you might not want tons of it in your in your American IPA. So just keep in mind, champagne yeast, sugar, and then flavor. They can also be made in, you know, as little as 10 minutes. And they could take, you know, as little as 4 days to ferment, depending on your temperatures.
And depending on your taste and how much alcohol you want in there.
Yep. And how much sweetness.
And how your and how hot your apartment is.
So the moral of the story is to brew a lot in spring, brew alternative ferments in summer.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of alternative ferments, I'd like to take this moment to remind our listeners of this Pruno contest that we have. We encourage all listeners and their friends and family to make Pruno, a batch of Pruno, which is a prison wine, which is basically an alcohol made from anything you can think you can get in a prison. Some fresh fruit, canned fruits, ketchup packets, dried fruit. Very often.
And I will put some recipes. I have not made my Pruno yet, I'll admit. But I'm going to put some recipes on my blog, mylifeoncraft.com, this week. I will make myself do it.
Yes. So, yeah, I already had a couple of people who have made some Pruno, and to some success, it was drinkable. So I think that that's a success when it comes to a prison wine. And if the goal is to get very drunk, then any alcohol will do. So remember to just make sure that there's something with sugar in it and something with that will collect yeast, or if you want to, I think we are.
We're allowing dry
champagne yeast. Yeah, mm-hmm. For any dry yeast, and it should be able to ferment, and you will have yourself, especially in this weather, a good prison wine in a couple of days.
And what we would love, so if you want to participate, we would love to hear from you. So tweet at us, Instagram at us. Send us an email at, we're all ferment about it for all of those things. And when is the show? What date is the show?
August 11th.
August 11th. So if we would love to hear from you, we're going to invite you guys to call in, or if you'd like to just shoot us an email, we can read your email out over the air, whatever, but we're excited.
Oh yeah. And if you're in Brooklyn or if you're in New York City, we could maybe interview you or something in person.
That's true. You could come into the studio with us.
Oh, yeah.
Come on, big old prison party.
All right, so we do have to address before, we have some pre-tapes from left over from the National Homebrewer Homebrewers Conference that we're finally going to play today.
And it's more fun accessories for your brewing needs.
Yes, that I desperately want. But anyway, we have to address. So a few weeks ago, we had Rob Handel on, and he was talking about making capers.
Mock capers
with unripe elderberries. So somebody had tweeted at us that unripe elderberries are poisonous, and that is true. They can. It's going to depend on the variety of elderberry, but they do.
But most of them contain...
Yeah. Cyanide.
Hydrogen cyanide. Yeah. Well, they contain glycoside, which turns into cyanide when it's metabolized in the body, when it's digested, rather.
Right. So we want to address that because we did look it up, and actually fermentation, basically the key is fermenting. So you don't want to drink a lot of elderberry juice, or roots are particularly poisonous, and then the unripe fruit as well.
Right. Basically, anything in this plant except for the berries are poisonous.
Yeah.
Apparently, there's been a lot of documented problems with people drinking teas made from the leaves, so don't do that. But elderberries, along with a lot of other kinds of fruits, and many other kinds of foods that we eat regularly actually are poisonous unless you cook them. One example is cassava. Another example is the fermented shark meat, where that's actually highly toxic unless it is fermented.
Yep. So I'm in I have two sources. So first is nordicfoodlab.org. That's N-O-R-D-I-C, foodlab.org. I'm just going to read this because they have a great recipe for elderflower. Not for cyanide. Elderflower and elderberry vinegar. And so they have a whole thing of this vinegar safe. So basically, they talk about, Rachel mentioned cassava. So cassava has one of the highest concentrations of cyanogenic glycosides, and it's often the cause of massive food poisonings in regions with drought or famine. Cassava products are harmful mostly in these moments because people are consuming it immediately before it is properly processed. So it's, you know, it says the root should always be cooked after being previously soaked and fermented. The fermentation lowers the pH and therefore also the potential release of cyanide from the glycosides. There was a study, there have been several studies actually that were done on cassavas. Now, to give you a little bit of background, this is what Rachel mentioned. Glycosides are molecules that include a sugar and another functional group. In the case of cyanogenic glycosides, the functional group is partly composed of a molecule of cyanide. So they're concentrated in vacuoles, which are these small bubbles that are distributed throughout the cytoplasm of the cell. So when the cell is harmed, like when you cut into it or bite into it, the bubbles break and the cyanogenic glycosides are released into the cytoplasm of the cell, that's the gel in the cell, where they can react with enzymes that will break the bond between the sugar molecule and the functional group. Then that becomes free cyanide and it can...
That's when it can get into your bloodstream and act as regular cyanide.
Exactly. So obviously the cyanogenic glycosides are slightly different in elderberries than cassava, but there's actually been a study done on elderberry fruit. It was done by a guy named Eugenius Pogorzelski, and it was published in the Journal of the Science of Food and Agriculture in April 1982. It's called Formation of Cyanide as a Product of Decomposition of Cyanogenic Glycosides in the Treatment of Elderberry Fruit, Sambucus nigra. So basically they found that after fermentation, the hydrogen cyanide in the fruit was greatly diminished. So fermentation does seem to be a very safe way to either decrease or diminish the cyanide in unripe elderberries.
Right. That being said, just don't go around eating unripe elderberries or regular elderberries for that matter off elderberry trees.
And you would not. Yeah, you wouldn't want a quick pickle. So you do want a true fermentation.
Right. With the bacteria breaking it down rather than like a salt brine.
No elderberry half sours.
No,
that's right.
No elderberry half sours.
But that's a good. So if we ever, you know, we'd love to hear from you guys.
Yeah,
Chris, you got anything to add?
Nope. I like elderberries when they're fermented, and I don't want to die. I do think that the amount of mysteries that you watch, there happens to be a lot of cyanide in those shows. And
that's because it was an easily, yes, easily right. available. So I watch a lot of British mysteries, old school British mysteries. It's true. And cyanide was an easily accessible poison back in the day. So it's like, pretty easy.
I don't find myself in too many situations where I see a lot of cyanide.
Well, no, we don't anymore.
Cyanide in apple seeds and also in all of the stone fruit seeds, there's a trace amounts of arsenic. So if you ate a lot of apple seeds, you would die of cyanide poisoning.
Probably get, yeah, pretty sick. So
crazy. Well, we're going to take a really, really, really quick break, and then we're going to come back with a couple pre-taped episodes from our experience at the National
Adventures Homebrewers in the NHC.
Yeah, that's right.
Hello out there, it's Steve Jenkins, I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Welcome back to episode 170 of Foment About It. We are half an hour into this show, but we're just getting started with our chapter two of today's show, which is a couple of recaps from some things we've found and learned and enjoyed at the National Homebrewers Conference this year that we have not been able to play just yet. We're going to go right into them. Let's do it.
I am on the expo floor with Rex Slagle of the Brew Bag. You guys are located in Plainville, Illinois. Obviously, regular listeners of this program know that I've only done Brew in a Bag since 2011. I'm a huge advocate for it. I have a sewing machine, so I have like five different brew bags at home. But you guys make a really high-quality bag. So talk a little bit more. It'd be great to have another perspective for a Brew in a Bag. Tell me a little bit about your angle.
Yeah. So the Brew Bag was born conceptually because I had a mash tun that I got for Christmas. I was about to launch into all grain. I had my equipment all set up. I got it for my kids for Christmas, and I went downstairs to put all the hardware together, and it didn't fit properly. So I went back upstairs and started researching other methods of brewing and came across Brew in a Bag. So I started looking for a bag, but I couldn't find one that met my expectations. And so I, too, made my own. And when I started using it, other brewers said, "Where did that come from? Where did you get that? Blah, blah, blah." And I ended up making a few for some of the guys. And one thing led to another, and so that's how the Brew Bag was born. But conceptually, the point of using a bag is it's really just a filter. And if you look at it from that perspective, that it is just a filter, it changes the processes ahead of getting the wort into the boil kettle. And what that means is, so instead of brewing with your equipment limitations in mind, meaning, you know, everything is done ahead of the extraction based on will it drain? Do I get a stuck sparge? We've all been taught that grind at 35 or 40 or 50, mash at 125 to 1.50 quarts per pound, and then you won't get a stuck sparge and you'll be happy and everybody's going to have a good day. But we're going to flip that on the other end and say, start with optimization in mind. Grind your grain in anticipation of its potential extraction and then use this filter and you'll never ever have a stuck sparge. You will reduce your grain usage. You will increase your efficiency. Your brew day drops from 6 or 6.5 hours to 3.5 hours. And you get to drink beer sooner and relax a little more. And you get to spend less money and use less grain and get the same beer or better. That's the whole story. One of the key components of the Brew Bag is using the same bag that you use to brew with as your hop bag. So effectively what you want to do is rinse your bag after you use it for your grain, right? Turn it inside out, rinse it a few times, turn it right side out, and find something to spread the bag open with. I made a really simple 3/8-inch copper tube spreader that I just simply made to the, you know, inner diameters of the kettle. I pounded the end shut after I curled it up on the end so it doesn't poke the bag.
So it's like a copper circle?
Not a circle. It's actually like a piece of pipe that I curled on the ends
Sort of a
half U, if that's what you want to call it.
Yep.
I put two of those together, made an X out of them, and wired them together with copper wire. And I drop that into my brew bag so it keeps the bag completely open. And I attach it to the pulley. I drop it into the boil kettle so it's completely suspended. It doesn't touch the bottom. And effectively, the hops then react to the turbulence of the water as they would normally if there was no bag in place. So instead of putting your hops in a hop sock or a hop bag and having them being constricted or constrained without that turbulent action that allows the isomerization to occur, you get a more full utilization because they act as if there's no filter in the kettle at all, right? So you literally can optimize the whole process, including grain and hops, without putting tube into the kettle. All you end up with is hop break which allows you to lose a plate chiller, which is the most effective heat transfer system that we know of, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. That's why all that stuff works.
Also, now, do you keep that suspended with a pulley over your brew kettle?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So you could use it for hot bursting, for instance.
Yeah. And I'm trying to encourage nano brewers or, you know, any sort of brew pub guys to use this thing in their system, 30-gallon, 40-gallon, whatever it is, whatever system you have, because, you know, those guys, even though they whirlpool, right, to cone the hops and do all that, and they use that as an effective utilization technique, ultimately what they're trying to do is keep the hops out of the beer, right, out of the wort. But they lose, whatever, 5, 6, 7, 10, 20 gallons, depending how big the system is, to the hops, because they can't get it out, right? So if they use the filtration system that's suspended just like this, all that comes back to them in saleable, right, 12-ounce beers on the counter, it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars in retail sales that they're missing because they can't get it out of the hops, right? And so this filter allows them to do exactly that. And we've made filters for a 1,200-gallon Bright tank. We've made it for 100-gallon conicals. We've made them for 55-gallon drums all day long. They absolutely work. They're very effective, incredibly strong, 400 pounds they can lift. They just work.
Awesome. And how do people get the brew bag?
Just go to brewinabag.com, you'll see that we've got 5-6 different stock sizes. We ship the same day or next day by 10:30 in the morning. We certainly make custom bags every day of the week almost. If there's something that's oversized or even a different application for that matter, folks in the coffee industry are using our bag. We didn't know it, right? So cold brew coffee is now one of our client bases. And we, in fact, have developed a new fabric. I shouldn't develop, but we're going to be making bags out of a new fabric, particularly aimed at the coffee industry. That's a 63-micron fabric. What we currently use is 210-micron. And so we'll be approaching that industry as soon as we get the fabric in place and
very
making
cool.
that happen as well. It's
huge.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it started with commercial brewers in New York. Maybe you know Toby's Estate Coffee. They were our very first customer for our bags, and we didn't know that that's what they were using it for. We thought they were home brewers having their bags shipped to their business. So after the third order, I called them and said, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Right? And they were like, dude, we use it for coffee. And so then the light bulb went off.
That's awesome. We keep cold brew coffee on Nitro Draft at home.
Yeah.
So, and I've been thinking about using a bag, but I haven't, so I'm very interested when you come out with your bag.
Yeah. Well, these work. They're 210 micron. They work for coffee, but we got some 63 and some 47 micron bags made, and we sent them to coffee makers, cold brew coffee guys, and said, give us some feedback. The 63 micron bag won hands down over the 47. It drains a little faster, and the sediment differential was inconsequential to what they were doing. So the 63-micron fabric is what we're after now. It's very, very hard to get. I'm not saying that from a sales perspective of trying to protect it, but as you go down in microns, you go up in price. And we finally have found some fabric or a manufacturer that is reasonably priced. So we can now sell these coffee bags in the same range, $30 to $40, depending on the size, not anything more than that, which makes it affordable for everybody. And they just last and last and last. So.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to meet you.
That's right. I'm excited about dealing with some 63-micron bags. Dang it. I'm definitely going to be reaching out. And I do agree that it's nice to yield a little more beer. You know, when we're brewing on a bigger system, it's not a huge deal losing, you know, 5 or 10 gallons at the end of a 15-barrel whirlpool to hop substrate. But every little bit counts. Every ounce counts. And especially on a lower level, and especially with the way hopping rates are these days, like all that matter soaks up a lot of beer. So any way to kind of get better yields and clarity is good stuff. And I think that bags are groovy for that. On to the next.
I'm at the National Homebrewers Conference in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm at the Blickman Engineering booth with Doug Grandland, and you guys have an exciting new product called Quick Carb. Which is of particular interest to me because I am always a last-minute quick carbonation kind of girl. So tell us how this works.
Well, this is going to save you from shaking that keg back and forth and trying to get it carbonated, and you're going to have some control doing it this way. So we're just releasing this. It'll be on the market in about 6 weeks. It's designed to be set up with a corny keg. You've got your standard ball lock connectors, your in and out, and you've got a pump here in line, and once you get these connected up, it's going to pull through the outlet side, and return through the inlet side. It's going to pull it through the pump, and as it goes through the pump, we got the T-fitting here with a carb stone inside. This hose here will be go out to your CO2 tank, and we've got a little chart here that comes with it. The chart, what you're interested in finding out is the temperature of your beer. Based on the temperature of your beer is what you want to set your carb pressure at. So you find the temperature of your beer, set your carb pressure up, start the recirculation, start your CO2. You'll see the CO2 start coming out on the outlet side of the tea here going back in. You'll do a recirculation for about 45 minutes to an hour, and you'll get your beer 90% carbonated in less than an hour, hour or less.
That is so awesome.
Ready to go.
That is awesome.
No shaking. Now, arms aren't tired
yes.
when you're done.
You know exactly where you're getting.
And you know exactly what you're getting. Based on the chart, you set it up right, you know your beer is where it should be.
So is this a matter of, like, if you have a colder beer, obviously, usually takes less time, like if you're doing the quick shake?
Yeah.
Is it going to be the same amount of time
yes.
and you're just putting less CO2?
Yes. Yeah,
okay.
you're just changing the pressure
okay.
based
right.
on the temperature so you don't overcarb.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So tell us again, this is going to be available in about 6 weeks, and
yeah,
what is it going to retail for,
it's
and where can people get it?
You can go to any Blickman retailer. We'll be carrying this. We will announce it to our retailers in a few weeks here so they can get it on their shelves, and they should be ready in about 6 weeks. It should retail for $179 for the unit.
I know what I'm getting for the next occasion where I deserve a gift. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks
it was a pleasure
stopping
meeting
by.
You.
It was a pleasure meeting you, too.
Let's be very clear about something right now. Mary's arms are very rarely tired when her beverages are being carbonated.
That's true.
I sell your beer with enjoy, Mary.
That's right. But still, we're usually trying to do 5 gazillion things at the same time while we're carbonating.
Yes.
Our kegs. Anyway, I am excited about the quick carb. It is available now. I think it's been available. It was started shipping for retailers on July 13th.
Now, one of the things that we think about is that, you know, when you have a very hoppy beer and you have a lot of volatiles, that you don't want to disturb your beer too much, but you always have to carbonate anyway. And some of the concern has been like, okay, well, if you're recirculating through this system and just upsetting it, and you know you're getting turbidity in there, and like you want to, when you're carbonating, you want to do it under pressure and keep the aromas in there. And that's the thing, it's a closed circuit, so it should be fine, and it is fine, and the jury's still out. We don't have one, but
this has been a debate between Chris and I, by the way. I believe you lose nothing.
I do too. It's not a debate between us. It's just a concern that people. It's not just me talking about it, by the way. I mean, I think actually because it's in a closed circuit, I think it should be totally fine. And also, we're only doing it for 45 minutes, and there's a thing. I think that it's more important more of a concern with hoppy beers than for other beers. And with anything like this, you're not going to necessarily want to drink it right after because the turbidity, it just will all be upset. I mean, everything benefits from some conditioning.
But if you start with clear beer,
right,
you're fine.
Right, if you already racked it off of a lot of stuff, yeah.
Well, if anybody else has any comments on this carbonation debate, tweet at us or send us an email.
But first of all, Blickman, though, is a brand to be trusted, no doubt, in the homebrewing scene. And,
dude, I'm
like,
totally
all
getting
the
one.
Stuff they do. I know. Next time you deserve a gift, trust me.
That might be tonight. No.
It's like 97 degrees.
I know. So that is it for tonight's episode. Good luck dealing with the heat wherever you are.
It's perfect Pruno weather.
That's true.
If you're feeling trapped, are you feeling imprisoned? Make Pruno.
We will be back. Actually, we'll be back from pre-record. We're going to next week. I'm actually speaking at the Westchester's Homebrewers Organization, Westchester Homebrewers Organization, the WHO, on Shortcut Sours, trouble-free tart beers.
That's right. And I'll be chauffeuring somebody to Westchester that night, so I can be.
That's true. So we are going to have some pre-tape. We're going to go around and visit a bunch of our guests, local guests that have been on the show before. So I look forward to getting updates from them and sharing them with you next Monday on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The Joe DePro series.
For men about it.
For men about it over here. We give you all the money.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Wall with no end on the banks of forgiveness. You clutch to your burden, the waters of baby.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaili, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.